Exception number 11744, rule 6.
And on December about 2nd, you came down to see me at 44 Heathcroft. I did say my name was right, didn't I? An ex-sergeant in the Air Force. And you did a series of tapes on the time that I spent in the Air Force. Peculiar things people have. I'm always frightened of shooting a terrific line, because sooner or later, if I do that, you'll find somebody who knows me, and there'll be that standard chant of, there I was, 30,000 feet over Cologne, upside down in a ball of fire, damn all on the clock by the maker's name, port out a gone, port in a gone, starboard in a gone, starboard out is still working, and the rear gunner shot to ribbons. Having listened to a bit of this tape again and realized what an awful mess I made of it, I'm going to do some more odds and bits. You need not listen to it beyond this if you don't want to. No. And the number is 11744, S for sugar. You'll find on about the 50th Revolution Observer Corps. Now, what was an Observer Corps post like? Well, simply, they were a sandbagged hole in the ground. You used to go out there, or I used to go out there, and there were two or three observers sitting in their little hole, tin hats on, microphones and earphones at the ready, somebody with a theodolite affair looking for aircraft, and they were the fastest people that I've ever seen at recognizing aeroplanes. Now, I had my moments when I wasn't bad. I could tell a hurricane from a Spitfire most times, anyway. But the Observer Corps, just given a glimpse, oinks miles away, would say, ah, Junkers 88, or Bowfighter, or whatever the thing was, and they were right. Now, I went to one near Colchester, fascinated by it. Each observer post, the little circle in the field, was connected to a main centre by telephone. Been a bit odd if it was done by drums, because telephones were quite good in the 40s. The centre, say at Colchester, at Bramley, Maidstone, Colchester, wherever it was, were all connected to a larger centre, and finally to Bentley Priory, and the results, filtered, were sent back to the stations. Northweald, Hornchurch, whatever it was. And plots were put on the board of the type of aircraft there was flying about at the time. Before the war, I was rather tickled with a book that I'd borrowed, bought, or something, called The £100 Millionaire, or perhaps it was £200 Millionaire. I have a copy at home now. It tells a series of short stories about sailing, and I was always quite keen on sailing anyway. It was by somebody called Weston Motter, and there in the Observer Corps centre, or field, you know, the hole in the ground, was Weston Motter himself. And merely the fact that I knew something about his books, I'd read several of them, meant that we could settle down, chatter about things that mattered, and he told us how the Observer Corps worked in far better way than ever I'd have known before. Except that much later on, when I'd left the Air Force and was teaching, my brother-in-law was an Observer Corps officer, and I used to go down and tell his Observer Corps people how difficult it was to tell one aircraft from another, how very little you could actually see from a fixed-wing aircraft, and if there was going to be another war. The probability is that somebody would creep in at 50 feet in a tiger moth or something and plant something very unpleasant on your doorstep. What I'll admit, in the Gulf War, the Air Force crept in 50 feet, but they came in 150 or 400 miles an hour and planted unpleasant things, which only goes to show that things are different from the old that we were used to and the 30, 40,000 that we were told to expect. Anyway, that's the Observer Corps. On about 71 revolutions, there is the old business of recognition. We could not, at one time, easily follow different aircraft. You remember I was talking about pipsqueaks and things. Now, God bless us all, we didn't know a lot about anything. And controlling was still rather a mystery to everybody, including excellent controllers, but we were out of practice. We didn't know what to expect. And we also didn't realize that radar stations would occasionally give back echoes. In other words, something flying inland could be read as something out to sea. Sounds difficult, but it's possible. And quite early in 940, we were a funeral party. Sounds terrible, but all the odds got fell in their best blue, carried three coffins, probably full of stones, along to the local church at Northweald, and we buried three pilots. Battle of Barking Creek, where three hurricanes, or some hurricanes, from Northweald were flying peacefully about their business over Barking Way. The Hornchurch controllers, like the Northweald controllers, had had an air raid warning and were looking for the opposition. The Spitfires from Hornchurch saw the hurricanes from Northweald, fell on them at a vast rate of knots and shot three down. That was the Battle of Barking Creek. Sorry about that, something seems to have gone wrong with the recording. Let me sling a little bit in about Rhine Crossing. I was a controller in Holland just before we crossed the Rhine. In a fantastic set called AMAS Type 70, Air Ministry Experimental Station. I was controlling a couple of Spitfires between two layers of cloud, a damn silly place to put them, but it just had to be. And I was happily warning them that there were umpteen American Air Force big boys about. There were also lots of friendly Mustangs. Now, that was easy. But whistling out of the top cloud came a couple of Mustangs, saw the Spits, bolted them hard, shot them down. Pilots escaped by parachute. The Mustangs went rejoicing back to England, had their cine films processed, and saw beautiful pictures of Spitfires going down in flames. Now, the two Spit pilots got out and went into prisoner of war camp. I was hauled out of Belsen, which I didn't like anyway, but I was hauled out anyway, and sent down to Brussels on a court of inquiry. I've never had a more terrifying flight in an aeroplane before. We were in an old Dakota. Paratroop Dakota, with tin seats facing inboard. There were the two American pilots, the two Spitfire pilots, umpteen people from the judge advocate's office of both parties, generally a right sort of collection of I hate you people. Very few pilots like being driven by strangers, and we had four pilots at least on board who hated being driven. I was sitting there as the actual controller. There was the duty control, all sorts of odd bits. And just as we crossed the Rhine from Schleswig, we looked out of the across the starboard wing, and there was oil dripping like mad from the starboard engine. So the pilot put the thing down on a little grass airstrip near the Rhine. His flight engineer got out with his big army boots and kicked the engine, put in more oil, and off we went to Brussels. Now, England was a sad place. No lights, nothing at all, nothing in the shops, food rationing like mad. Belsen was pretty horrible. The only thing that kept us going in that was Bolsh gin that the Society of Friends provided us with. And then we arrived in Brussels, and it was like fairyland. Lights on, shops all lit up, incredible goods in there, silk stockings and all the things that you could just imagine that happened. We could have bought teddy bears by the dozen, things that you hadn't seen for years. It was just a wonderful place, and it was a joy to ride on trams. What happened at the Court of Inquiry doesn't really matter. We sort of went and did our stuff, but that was that. Nobody sort of lost any sleep over it. I don't think anybody was executed. It was just singularly bad luck. I was talking about the DF stations that were also sort of picking up voice transmissions and picking up pipsqueak transmissions. We used to visit them occasionally because they got lonely. They were stuck out in the wilds. Besides that, if we went up to a place called Southwold, you must know it, with a lighthouse in the middle of the town. Pubs there were on their peacetime ration, and we could buy enormous steaks, whole meal for about 3 and 6 pence. Terrific! And one of the places, the DF stations near it, was run by a corporal, and I think that he and most of his DF crew were gypsies, travellers, not the didicoys, but the genuine article. It was a toss-up as to whether we go to an hotel and get a really super steak at about 3 shillings and 6 pence at the outside, or go and feed with them. And if you fed with a gypsy and his mob of DF wallers, you'd get a large ladle and a big dish, rather like a soup plate. And you'd fill the soup plate from the cauldron that was always bubbling away over a wood fire, and you got all sorts of bits and pieces. There'd be pheasant, rabbit, any odd beef that was lying about, dumplings, stew, stewed vegetables, all sorts of absolutely lovely things, and it was always a superb meal. What it cost them, I don't know, but it didn't cost us much apart from cigarettes. Now, I'm trying to talk about bold heroes and ordinary airmen and sort of strange and everyday things that happened. Now, I'm going to talk for a moment about the 3940s, when I was fortunate enough to meet a corporal called Bob Cotton. He was a boxer, Air Force champion at, I should think, about middleweight. Now, in the winter of 39-40, it was bitterly cold. Snowed like the devil. Northfield was a desolate-looking place. Hangars standing up white in the middle of white fields. And Bob Cotton and his bold heroes, we were the guard, used to walk about with staves in our hands. We couldn't afford rifles. Making sure that our homes were safe from saboteurs and things. And he was such a kind and gentle chap. Now, I was doing this one night, and everybody had to have a bash at guard duty, no matter what you did. And we were rounding a hangar, and there was the happy sound of 303 rifle bullets floating about. Apparently somebody was on guard, on watch, or on doing something or another. They weren't in our particular guard party, because they couldn't. And he'd gone nutty and suddenly was shooting everybody, or shooting at everybody in sight. Nothing to do with us, you know, this was his war. It was, I think, in about the springtime of 40, long before the Battle of Britain or Battle of France and things, that we had a strange aeroplane came in. Single-seater, twin-engined, a rate of climb that was phenomenal, and a turn of speed that was equally phenomenal. It was a beautiful aeroplane, thing called a Westland Whirlwind. It shot round our hangars like the clappers of hell. And we were used to seeing a chap called Donaldson, squadron leader Donaldson, ex-Snyder Trophy bloke, really whistling round the hangars as though he meant it in hurricanes. But this thing was infinitely faster. But Goering ran across the same trouble. He'd developed a thing called a 110, which he called a destroyer. Fast armament, all that sort of stuff. But twin-engine maintenance, rate of turn wasn't as good as a single-engined aircraft, triple the maintenance, I should think, and for that reason, and the other one was that the Whirlwind had contraplops, you know, one spinning one way and one t'other. They were never really developed until much later, and I think we had two or three squadrons of them. One was led by a chap called Squadron Leader Warnford. And he did anti-shipping stuff. However, that's something else that doesn't matter, does it? On about Revolutions 154, I was talking about the 360-foot towers of the Chain Home Low. The odd thing about them was that the WAFs used to climb up to the different stages of this thing and sunbathe. And we cowardly characters used to creep our way up there because we were afraid not to. They were just bare towers, like electricity pylons, with a ladder crawling up the inside. And I've always been frightened of heights of over 6 foot. If I looked over the side of a wall, I sort of shut both eyes. But at any rate, we didn't have the nerve not to go up these confounded towers. I used to be worried going up onto the aerodrome lookout on top of the hangars, merely because you were going up 60 foot with absolutely nothing much to hang on to except a steel ladder. However, more about that later. You've heard about the aerodrome lookouts, who used to say, three Spitfires of whatever squadron, three Hurricanes of such and such a squadron taking off, one Hurricane of whatever it is doing dusk landings. He was doing that once with one Hurricane of something squadron, doing dusk landings, and apparently the thing was whipping off the ground, doing a circuit round the hangars and landing, which was quite a legitimate pastime, except that over on the far side of the airfield was a Blenheim of 25 Squadron, a converted day bomber, turned night fighter, and it was their only one that was serviceable. And in the cockpit was a radio mechanic, sorting out the night's frequencies, and the Hurricane went belting across the aerodrome. Something had gone wrong with the hydraulics on the brakes or something, and it ran poor old F for Freddy, their only serviceable Blenheim. The propeller of one of them flew straight up in the air and came down quivering in front of the radio mechanic, which didn't please him or anybody else for that matter. The last I saw of that Hurricane pilot, he was running like blazes with 25 Squadron going to murder him. Now, one of the main sources of strength in any Air Force was the ACHGD, the Aircraft Hand General Duties. He was grossly underpaid. Well, he earned all the 3 and 6 a day. I think he earned about 2 and 6 months. 25 pence, thereabouts, you know. I knew we were very vexed one day when we went to bed in our little hut on the parade ground, having been on duty for 16 hours, I suppose, and there was a carpenter there hammering like mad. And we remonstrated with him gently, and he said that he was very busy repairing the roof of our hut. Wouldn't it be nice if it didn't leak? And we said, wouldn't it be nice if we could get some sleep? And there we were, all on our 3 and 6 a day or thereabouts. And this joker was earning 27 quid a week. More than that, I think. But he was insistent that he was right, because he was earning danger money for being on an aerodrome. Well, I mean, it all goes to show something. But at any rate, ACHGDs, marvellous people. Their main trick was to walk around the airfield with an empty wheelbarrow, always doing nothing beautifully. Failing that, they had an Air Force bicycle, which was a big sit-up-and-beg postman pat affair, and a very large file or clipboard with nothing on it. And the ACHGD would go pedalling round the airfield, and by an odd coincidence, he'd turn up at the dispersal or one of the radio rooms or something like that, just as the tea was being brewed. And as he never had any pennies in his pocket, somebody would give him tea and a wad. If it rained, you'd find him with a bicycle in bits down in a boiler room where it was nice and warm. We had an ACHGD whose job was to sweep the ops room floor. I'd been discharged from that duty at the time. And nice bloke. I always remember once when there was an air raid warning, and we were supposed to get our gas masks ready and things like that. And in came the gas officer, who was a funny little First World War ex-pilot officer, complete in his tin hat, his gas mask, a strange-looking outfit on top, seemed to be made of oilskin, and the ACHGD looked up and said, God, it's Shag the Beekeeper. Oh, the next day, he wasn't popular. The next day he went out to London, drink beer and meet some girls, I suppose, and he was late back. And he got fell in front of the boss for missing his first watch or whatever it was. And just as he was about to be summoned, sentenced for awfully missing his watch and being off duty at the right time, when the police and the fire service rang up. Apparently he'd been up in London, somebody had dropped a bomb, a house had gone up in flames, and there was our dear ACHGD doing a remarkable job of rescuing people. He damn nearly got a medal for it instead of being sentenced. Round about 2:02 on the clock, I was talking about Victor Francis Beamish, a wonderful man. He was the station commander, the crew captain, he must have been. He used to have his funny little side hat on. He used to wear an ordinary airman's boiler suit, enormous ammunition boots, and at dawn or before dawn, you'd see him trotting round the perimeter track to his Hurricane. He used to fly regularly on anything that looked like a fight. He was very Irish. He actually laid out an Irish labourer who wasn't working and argued with him. And he knew everybody, all 2,000 of us, on his aerodrome. He complained bitterly one day at having to fly at 22,000 feet in a hurricane because it was dangerous, you know, that was above the service limit, really. But he did everything, and he just was a wonderful man. The odd thing was, as I say, that he knew everybody on his aerodrome. I'd just been made up to sergeant. I was keen on tennis, and all dressed up in my white flannels and a terrible-looking blazer that I spoke about, looked like a frightened deck chair cover. Or do you remember those covers they used to put in front of varnished front doors to keep the sun off them? That sort of thing. And halfway along to the tennis courts on North Weald, I was on mid-totter meeting somebody to play, and he said, "Ah, Sergeant Wright, I am so sorry. I've not seen you for 3 days since you just got your third stripe. Congratulations. How lovely to see it. I'm so pleased for you." Now, for a bloke that could drive a whole aerodrome, could fly like a maniac, could incite all his pilots to do feats beyond their imagination, that could remember one solitary-looking ground staff bloke and say congratulations, it was wonderful. That blazer, as I say, was bombed when North Weald was bombed. Ultimately, it was dug up, and in one of the pockets was my passport, some German railway tickets, because I'd taken a bicycle over to Germany and been youth hosteling in 37, 38, round about there. And for some reason, I'd left them in my pocket. There was nobody at home because my father was back on the Dover patrol. Mother had gone down to a flat with him, and the house was empty. And it struck me as being safer with me than at home. But I had an awful lot of explaining to do when it was found. I was sort of Rudolph the horrible German spy, you know, this sort of nonsense. Queer things happen. 237, that sort of number. I called at Ongar in February 91. We were on our way on holiday, going to Great Dunmow. Actually, we were creeping round looking at all the places I'd served in, and my wife put up with it, God bless her. And we called at Ongar, and we saw the place where the WAFs lived. At the back of the church, we couldn't see the duck pond, but it was snowy, and it was a bit dicey walking round the little narrow path. And I sort of whispered to my wife that in that place, where a few of the officers lived too, we used to go there and stoke the fire at night, which vexed us, because, usual cry, if we were on duty, we were on duty, and we had to nip off and do this sort of stoking job. And we used to pee on the coke, and it stunk the place out to high heavens. But still, that's neither here nor there. But Ongar hadn't changed. It looked just as lovely as ever. and 291, there are all the bold heroes about. But one never hears of the cowardly, everyday people like me. There was a chap called Bowen, bloody old Nobby Bowen. I forget his Christian name, but again, he's one of the unlucky ones. I was best man to three people. He was one of them. As mad as a hatter, he used to rush around like a demented ferret. And we slept on bedboards in, I think, in one of the married quarters for a time. And you'd just get your head down, be fast asleep, and Nobby Bowen had come up, tipping up every bedboard in sight. And he was so damn rapid that by the time we crawled out of our blankets, there he was gone. He tried hard to become an RO, a radar observer, and night fighters, but for some reason was turned down. I can never understand why. Chap who tested him was Saw Daniels, one-armed squadron leader who'd Prangdenham. Denham, into Epping Forest. And he got away with just one arm. Poor old Nobby got his commission and was on his way out to Malta or Gibraltar, one of the two. Usual thing, was going out by Hudson down through the bay and got picked up by some 88s, I suppose. It happened. But can you imagine the terror of the poor bloke? Being driven by somebody he didn't know, trying to get into a small patch of diminishing crowd and being shot at all the time, knowing that you weren't fast enough to escape or anything, and then going down into the cold, cold water. In 1929, I was in hospital with diphtheria up in Woolwich. And we were living at the time in Brockley in southeast London. While I was in hospital, my parents had the brilliant idea that they were going to move to some new houses in New Eltham, very close to here. And that they did. I think with any luck, they thought they might have lost me, but